You know, I have memories of Prospect Park as a Brooklyn kid, having birthday parties and spending so much time playing Manhunt and, you know, going to concerts. And then now, as an adult with two children, it's creating new memories in this space.
Many of us have fond memories of parks, but public spaces, spaces created for shared enjoyment, are not always welcoming. They aren't always treated as spaces for everyone.
I remember this one case, Prospect Park. A gentleman called me because there were these, there were Mexican-Americans that were barbecuing in a part of the park where barbecuing wasn't permitted. And so he called me, stop it, sent out the enforcers to stop this from happening. Why force these families to walk another half a mile across the park when literally this space was two blocks away from where they live?
I'm Brian Lowry, professor at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, a social psychologist by training and by temperament, just a plain curious person. In this podcast series, Know What You See, I talk to people from a wide range of backgrounds about their own experiences with race and power. I grew up in public parks. My friends and I would leave the house in the morning and be out until the sun was going down. Much of the time would be spent hanging out and playing sports in parks. Family reunions, barbecues, softball, all in parks.
Mayor de Blasio is cracking down on social distancing, and that's going to mean that access to some of the city's parks will be restricted.
Over the last year or so of the pandemic, I think people have found a new appreciation for the value of shared space. There's nothing like not having something to make you appreciate it. We've also learned anew that race is embedded in shared space. There have been a number of racially tinged events in public spaces.
There is an African-American man. I am in Central Park. He is recording me and threatening myself and my dog.
The Coopers in Central Park and accusations of trespassing in Oakland.
This lady right here wants to sit here and call the police on them for having a barbecue at the lake as if this is not normal.
How do we get here? Who decided that public space only belongs to some of the public? Who decides what goes in public spaces? And what's the impact of these decisions? For example, what are we to make of monuments to Confederate generals? How do these monuments affect who belongs? And who feels comfort and ownership of the space? What's changing about how we create, claim, and share space? And what needs to change? There's been a long history of underdevelopment and exclusion of people of color, and Black people in particular, in well-funded public spaces. Spaces maintained educational and wealth disparities, and maintained distance between people that helps us ignore the magnitude of these inequities.
There are battles that people like saying, you're not putting basketball in this park, which means, code word, we don't want Black people, urban youth, in this park.
That's Mitchell Silver, commissioner for the New York City Parks Department. I spoke to Mitchell as a part of my webinar series for the Stanford Graduate School of Business.
I mentioned barbecue, basketball, and there are some people that don't want those uses there because that's not the kind of feeling they want to offer their public space. So it's designed to be exclusive. Am I welcome in this park? Do I feel welcome in this park? And in some cases, the answer is no.
Mitchell describes a common experience. Maybe you've had the experience of not belonging yourself in some public space. The question is, how did we get here? What are the roots of this exclusion?
First, we have to go back in time. And how cities were organized, just developed, making sure you had roads, sidewalks, and then you had housing, commercial. But as cities became dense, they were looking for those open spaces, those places where people can go and escape and relax. I mean, people initially started going to cemeteries. They realized that these open spaces need to be created. And then there was this whole movement, the late 19th century, early 20th century, where they started really focusing on city planning and, for that matter, creating parks and public space. As it relates to public space, it primarily comes from government. In the past, it was top-down, but today it's more of a conversation.
Here's Richard Rothstein, a journalist focused on economic policy.
New York City is a very segregated community, but most cities of this country, African Americans in particular, have less adequate parks, less adequate utilities and access to transportation. The interaction of private space and public space is largely determined by a racial history. The reason we have segregation in every metropolitan area in this country, including in New York, is because of very explicit racial policy implemented through the mid-20th century by federal, state, and local governments, designed to ensure that African Americans in particular and whites could not live near one another in any metropolitan area of this country. And so unless we understand the unconstitutional nature of the way in which families are distributed throughout a community by race, we can't overcome the inertia that allows us to keep things the way they are.
Mitchell says the policing of public spaces is just another tool for dividing communities.
I mean, if you look at how these parks were built, high fences, they're caged in, our municipal pools were disgraceful. You know, I want to talk about some of the rules, which I find quite offensive. We had rules about what you can wear, no hoodies and hats, no loitering, which I always had a problem with, because loitering means that you can sit or stand idly by with no apparent purpose, and that's what you do in a park. But that word could be weaponized. Rules in parks can be weaponized, that if people are uncomfortable with a certain individual, they will have a rule to prevent them to enjoy themselves freely in a democratic public space like a park.
It's no surprise to Richard and Mitchell that parks created in Black and brown communities fall short in terms of quality. And they also emphasize that these communities need them most.
Why is it that African Americans and Hispanics are more likely to want to barbecue in a park than whites? It's not it's not some kind of cultural trait that was inherited from Africa or Mexico or something. It's because African Americans are living in more overcrowded neighborhoods where their social life must take place outside their homes.
Part of the reason Black and brown communities are so overcrowded is because the federal government for a long time redlined neighborhoods that didn't allow Black and brown communities to expand into more suburban areas.
People liking to barbecue in the park, it's a great tradition, but it has historical origins in public policy that was explicitly designed on the basis of race to concentrate African Americans in more crowded neighborhoods and not give them access to the kinds of higher opportunity communities that whites had.
Think about why you go to parks. Parks and other public spaces are not just about access to more space. They are also places we go to be renewed, to have a feeling of belonging and comfort.
Those parks are your front yard, your backyard. They're places for not just for physical health, but for mental health. And so a lot of this goes into the design of the space, but the intent is, do you feel welcome? Is it a diverse park where you see all people of all colors, of all races? And if you don't see that, you have to dig deeper to find out why. Why don't you go to this park? What makes you feel uncomfortable?
Parks are not the only spaces we share. As we walk through our neighborhoods, we're surrounded by buildings that make up our shared space. I wanted to talk to someone who designs structures to better understand how buildings affect and shape our experiences. So I spoke to Ibrahim Greenidge. He's the founder of Bolt Architecture in Brooklyn.
I spent the summer constructing a shed with my grandfather. And with that experience of being outside in the summer heat, watching my grandfather put this box of parts together, which is basically a real life model. It was the same thing like an erector set. It really did ingrain some things that I took with me through college and for the rest of my life.
As we talked more about space, Ibrahim told me about an experience he had as a grade school student in Brooklyn.
A classmate of mine, Gavin Cato, died as a result of a car accident, we'll say. That car accident was sort of the spark to the Crown Heights riots.
Angry mobs ran through Crown Heights. Rocks and bottles were thrown, shots fired. It all happened after a car driven by a Hasidic Jew jumped a curb.
In August 1991, a race riot erupted in Brooklyn between Orthodox Jews and the local Black community.
But during the Crown Heights riots, what I would see are sort of outside and away from Eastern Parkway, where a lot of the damage was happening, my school was in a stone's throw of that street.
While the riot was the most dramatic event tied to space, it wasn't the only clash Ibrahim remembered.
One day after school, I witnessed an event where a group of students from the middle school were walking across the street. A car was approaching the intersection, and a couple things were said. you know, the driver kept on pulling to the light, got to the light. But within a matter of minutes, the car was surrounded. They were pounding on the car, damaging it, and the car was basically lit ablaze. The person in the car, though, it seemed was more afraid to sort of get out of the car and maybe run or be beat up than stay in the car. What it really made clear to me is this real fight over space. I didn't have a language for it. So I sort of put that in the back of my head, like, people are willing to die over space. Fast forward, my family then moves to this beautiful town called Elmont, which is on the border of Nassau County and Queens County. A lot of first generation of immigrant parents, like my grandparents, moved to this community because they thought that they were providing their children and their families with this new opportunity. But what it meant to a lot of white families is the education is going to fall and they have to leave. So I had teachers leave, friends leave, all sorts of things happening. While this is happening, we're being told to take occupational outlook classes. So I take a couple classes, I take some tests, they're telling me I should become a shop teacher or a mechanic. And my dad gets upset and he says, no, you're not gonna do that. Why do we always have to be at the bottom? It's about time we're at the top. I need you to become a designer, an architect, or someone who's creating the stuff rather than the person at the bottom. You could become the person who's designing the airplanes, not the mechanic fixing them. So I was like, all right, Dad. So I'm like, all right.
As we know, Ibrahim did not become a mechanic. And as an architect, he discovered that his skills could serve his community.
When I was working at a firm, I was probably 25 years old. It was the height of the housing crisis that happened. And at the time, I was managing probably about 25 projects at this architectural firm. And they had a history of doing a lot of infrastructure work and educational work. The educational work basically dissolved and dried up. The result was this sudden, basically explosion in need for correctional work. I went to Rikers, conducted multiple surveys, which are, you know, documentation of existing conditions, verification of what the building is, how damaged is it, can it accommodate more beds. Manhattan Detention Center, which many people here on Law and Order is known as the Tombs. The reality really struck me when I realized that I was one of the only, beyond it being a guard, correctional guard, a black person under the age of 30 who was free to walk from room to room, space to space, and not shackled. It forced me to really make a decision at that moment in time. That was like the real awakening point. I quit my job and I started my company. Architects, architecture, all of the people who are purveying the built environment are complicit in this entire ecosystem or structure of white supremacy. And the only way that I thought that I could sort of fix it or create a dent in it is if I had more people who look like me in it.
Hudson Yards on Manhattan's far west side is a commercial and residential wonderland featuring some of the city's tallest buildings and most expensive restaurants and condos. Some see the project as a welcome addition to the nation's largest city, but others think its exclusive offerings mean exclusion for too many.
I think that the role of an architect today has to be one where we are a part of the community, where we're taking heed to what the community is telling us. You know, imagine if the West Side Project was one where the community said, look, we want a 2-acre park, spaces for community performances. We want to grow food. You know, we want to provide opportunities for people in the community to sell some of their products. All imagine if there was that approach rather than it being, I want to build this building and I'm going to live in the top apartment because I can afford to and I financed the construction.
All these places where space and this idea of whose space is it collide, right? And I'm just wondering, how do you think about that when you're designing your spaces? How does that concept of ownership come into the way you think about the work that you do?
It's really tough. I'm really trying to figure out innovative ways now within the practice that we can do that. So, like, for instance, the opportunity has come on our desk where we are going to be designing about 100 homes in Ohio. I'm already looking at it like, great, how can we get black people to get into these developments? Because I already know what this means. And the guy looks at me, and this is a black guy. He looks at me and he's like, well, there are not really too many black people nearby. I'm like, great. Well, how can we create an ecosystem that allows us to take advantage of this? So it's been this sort of forced injection that I've been doing to a lot of my projects where I'm creating these opportunities in some of my buildings and spaces. All right, you want a store and two apartments? Cool, here you go. Here's your store and two apartments. Here's a space that we can sort of create new some innovation from. Maybe it's a space that allows for people to sort of come in there and work and create things for the community, like wood shop. So it's these things that I've been sort of encouraging, pushing into some of my projects that I think have been really impactful and aimed at helping our people.
I wanted people like me to see the work. I didn't want it to be behind a wall. And so I want everyone to see it. Like, I want it to be in the public space because I like the interaction as well. It might get buffed. Somebody's going to tag it, maybe. I want my work for the people. Like, I want it for the people.
This is Constance Patton, a Detroit-born street artist and New Yorker for the last 16 years.
I grew up in a family of artists. I grew up with my grandmother mostly, who was an artist. We had a kiln in the basement. She did bead work every day. My other grandmother made quilts. You know, the idea of recycling or like reuse is something that in our culture as a Black American, like we've been doing that, like from cutting bottles to make planters to cutting up old clothing, putting them together as like blankets. I grew up, you know, with a lot of support in being creative.
Constance grew up during a time of considerable economic hardship in Detroit. One of the things she remembered was the way artists reclaimed some of the abandoned homes around her neighborhood.
When I was growing up in Detroit, there were areas that were completely devastated. You know, what would happen is a lot of the artists, the local artists, who you wouldn't even know who they were, would come and take over those spaces and beautify them. They paint them. They turn these like homes that were abandoned into sculptures, essentially. An example is the Heidelberg Project, which is on the east side of Detroit.
34 years in the making, the Heidelberg Project is an outdoor art environment in the heart of Detroit with the mission to improve the lives of people and neighborhoods through art.
It was something that no one talked about. Like now it's street art is like, it's like street art. Banksy, you know, and when we were just like growing up, it was, you just saw it and you kind of saw those takeovers. So with this particular project, that's my influence. Like I wanted to come and kind of beautify the city.
One of Constance's main works is a street mural depicting a woman. She calls the piece Amani.
Well, the background is yellow. It's 8x8. It was on plywood board. It's a figure, just the portrait of a head, and she's smoking a spliff. She's a brown-skinned woman. She's got her third eye. She says be a lover and has kind of like chokers and earrings. And it's bright. It's like really bright. So those pieces are altars. They're healing spots. And the reason I really love these is they're really meant to heal people and like just let people like chill for a minute. They can like pull up for 30 seconds and, you know, like kind of vibe out and then go about their day.
For Constance, making the Amani piece was a way to manage the trauma she and the community felt about George Floyd's murder.
Business is burned to the ground as demonstrators demand answers and they demand action in the death of George Floyd.
Certainly for George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement. That piece was really important because after the lockdown, you know, which was just so devastating for every person, that was the first thing I did outside.
During this time, with the pandemic nearing its height and Black Lives Matter protests occurring often, businesses all around Soho were boarded up, and these pieces of plywood served as blank canvases for street artists.
When I got down here, it was a Sunday morning at 10 a.m. I met with Westwood Gallery, this guy, James, who owns Westwood, and he runs the Soho Broadway Initiative. It was really surreal. I didn't have any paint. I had my old bag of indictment, my like graffiti bag. And so it had like a few paints in it and everything was closed, but James gave me some paint and I went and did that piece and I remember feeling so rusty. and just kind of like, but like this crazy rush. But that piece, Imani, that was the first time where I didn't have to think about painting for somebody else. It was like my own work. It was healing for me, and it was healing for the people. Like, people were stopping and like talking and taking photos, and it was kind of like, it's weird because my white friends were like, it was a festival, and I was like, it was trauma to me. Like, it was so traumatic. This, like, everyone's racism is showing, but that piece there gave me the courage, and I started coming and painting every single day.
What do you think about the commercialization of the street art scene? So, because on one hand, it's like, it means like more people are paying attention now, right? Like, now it's like all these Instagram accounts that are just street art, right? It wasn't like that before, right? So people like are seeing your stuff. But on the other hand, it seems like it could have some downsides. I just wonder what you think about how it's changing the space, how it's affecting you.
What was weird with my work in particular and the works that were created this last year in this particular movement is that our work was commodified without us having a part of it. So I think that part is really gross. But, you know, it's also like we live in a capitalist society, so our society can commodify anything, literally. They stole my work off the walls last year and were trying to sell it to museums. You know, they're like, oh, it's street art like Banksy. I'm like, first of all, how dare you? They basically are taking the work and taking it from the people.
Right. So I guess I wonder, like, you know, like, yeah, you've been all over the world. You're doing street art. You're doing big commissions in New York. Who is it for?
It was for, like, me when I was a kid, basically. You know, not just me, but people like me. I want, like, younger Black girls, boys, like, older people that are afraid to go in institutions because they're not welcoming. It's not like you walk up to the Met and it's like, come in. It's got a weird vibe, you know? I didn't know if I wanted to be, like, in a gallery with my pinky up, which is cool. I like that, too, you know? It's crazy the amount of Black women I have cried with. But, like, I don't know what to do. They're, like, big tears because they haven't seen themselves in those spaces. So a big part of this project is claiming spaces.
After talking to Constance, I've wondered how people that focus on buildings think about street art. For a long time, street art was seen as a problem, a nuisance to be stopped. So I talked to Ibrahim about it. I'm really into street art, and I'm curious what you think about it as an architect. Historically, it was like guerrilla approach to, like, you know, taking over space, right? And marking spaces, who owned it and who didn't. I wonder, how do you, with your architect hat on, how do you think about taking over space?
We had that pleasure on one of our projects. It's called Arrogant Swine. Yes, Arrogant Swine, it's in Brooklyn. This was another one of these projects that, it's one of these passion projects where the client is a former tech guy who decides he wants to quit his job and open the first of its kind, North Carolina style barbecue joint, beer garden in Bushwick or in Brooklyn. And but the best part of the building was not the Shugubiban bar, but the Bushwick Art Collective came and put these beautiful murals on the exterior of this building. You know, the artwork was, I believe it was in Nigeria where those 200 girls were missing. So there was a huge mural dedicated to that. And it really did bring this, like, vibrant feel to not only the exterior space, but the interaction between the community and the building itself. So it made it a little bit more inviting. So that project, it still remains, you know, one of my favorite projects. The artwork is still on the building.
It's easy to think about racial inequities in space in a distant, abstract kind of way. We focus on viral video clips and forget that these are people's lives, people's real lives. But these experiences capture the way we all live. Public space is surprisingly personal, surprisingly intimate. Let's go back to where we started, the parks, with Commissioner Silver.
In terms of parks, during COVID here in New York City, I call it the sanctuary of sanity. When people were locked at home and couldn't go out, every gathering place was closed. Parks was the only public gathering place that remained open. And so people were going there for their physical health, for their mental health. It was a stage, an office. It was everything you can think of. People were getting married in public spaces. And so for us, it's our gathering places. before COVID, festivals, events, they became those social places where people of all races and all colors can come together.
Commissioner Silver, you already mentioned COVID and how it's creating an incredible demand for outdoor public space, some sanctuary, I think you called it. But you also see, or at least there are reports of people moving out of cities. And obviously the people moving out are people of means that either already have other places to go or can afford to buy somewhere else. So how do you imagine this will affect cities?
I've been asked this question quite a bit, and I try to distinguish what is a trend and then what is trendy. What I do know is that we are going to have to reinvent the public space. We've seen play streets. We've seen shared streets. We've seen restaurants now occupying parking spots. We're now looking at the reinvention of our public space, and I believe that's going to stay with us. And you're going to see less and less cars dominating our public realm. So I do think that's going to be in our future in one form or the other.
When we think about our personal lives, who we are, what's dear to us, we tend to focus on private spaces, our homes with our things, furniture and knickknacks, things collected on trips, photos with friends and loved ones. These spaces reflect who we are. It's easy to think of public spaces as places where we need to wear a costume or armor, but maybe the line between public and private is less clear than it seems. Public spaces also tell us who we are, whether we belong or not, if we are important, if we are powerful. We negotiate our history, our identities, our relationships to each other in public spaces. Public spaces tell us where we've been and point to where we hope to go. We are social creatures. Who we are is shaped by the spaces we share. Maybe we're never more ourselves than when we're out in the world with others. And allowing us to see each other, public space gives us the chance to know ourselves. That's it for this episode. I'm Brian Lowry. Know What You See is produced by PRX in collaboration with the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Our production team is Jocelyn Gonzalez and Amy Chan from PRX Productions. Executive producer from the Stanford Graduate School of Business is Bernadette Clavier, with content production by Katie Wallace. To connect with me or to check out my webinar series, follow me on Twitter at Brian Lowry, PhD. Thanks for listening. Don't forget, know what you see.